flesh from their nostrils. Dr. Yang was at the hospital, in a ward jammed with squalling babies, emaciated limbs and bloated bellies. Yet even though the babies were being fed with the supplies sent by the International Red Cross, they were still dying. She was making love with the handsome doctor from Beijing, but she could not give herself to him totally because she could hear the painful crying of the babies through the thin curtains they had pulled around the bed. The doctor returned to Beijing the next morning without even bidding her farewell, and the babies continued to whimper and shriek and die. "They are not dying of malnutrition," Dr. Yang knew, and even as she said that to herself, her dream changed, shifted, mutated. The babies were astronauts. The hospital ward was the dome on the red surface of Mars. She felt totally helpless. Why are they dying? It is my responsibility to save them, to help them, to keep them alive and return them to health. It is my responsibility to remember. Remember. She sat bolt upright in her bunk aboard the Mars 2 spacecraft, instantly awake. But she could not remember what the dream was trying to tell her. Earth. Washington. Staring out her hotel room window, Edith held the phone tightly against her ear.
"You're fired, Edie,"
said Howard Francis's angry, rasping voice. The first thought that went through her mind was, "There goes the expense account." "But why me?" Edith asked. "I tried to get you." Francis's voice screeched.
"You had a fucking story an hour and a half before anybody else, and you just sat on it. We could have been on the air before all the other networks, even before CNN, if you had done your job right."
"I tried to get y'all. I tried to get through to the news director, but some shitty little tramp wouldn't let me."
"She was the assistant news director, for Christ's sakes. You should have told her."
"She would have cut my throat."
"So what? The network would have been first on the air with the biggest story of all time."
"Fuck the network," Edith thought. Aloud, she said, "I tried to tell her how important it was. She just wouldn't believe me. I bet even if I told her what it was, she would have thought I was just some nut."
"Oh, my God, Edie, my own ass is in a sling around here. I'll be lucky if they don't fire me."
"That'd be too bad," Edith said, her voice brittle with anger. "I hope they fire all you assholes," she added silently as she hung up. Later that morning, when Alberto Brumado picked her up on his way to NASA headquarters, Edith told him her sad news. "Well," he said, glancing around the quietly opulent hotel lobby, "I suppose you could move in with me." Edith felt her brows go up. Brumado smiled his boyish smile. "There is a guest suite on the top floor of the house. You can have complete privacy. I did not mean to suggest anything more." Edith gave him a smile in return. "I appreciate it, Alberto. I sure need a place until I can find a job." "Perhaps I can help you there, too. I have many acquaintances among the media people." Edith marveled at how smart Brumado really was, understanding that the media people he knew were acquaintances, not friends. Sol 38. Morning. Jamie awoke well before dawn. The wind had stopped. He lay flat on his bunk, listening. The storm must be over. There was no sound of the wind, no sounds in the darkened rover at all, except Connor's fitful snoring and the faint rustling of Joanna turning on her bunk just above him, and the ever-present background hum of electrical power and air fans. Slowly, silently, he slid out of the bunk and padded in his socks and coveralls to the cockpit. He pulled back the thermal shroud. Still black night outside. There was no discernible moonlight on Mars. Its two satellites were too tiny to shed much light on the planet's surface. Jamie switched on the rover's headlamps. The air was clear. He could see the cliff wall out there standing gray and rugged like the ghost of some ancient grandfather. Quickly, he turned the headlamps off, closed the shroud, and crept back to his bunk, satisfied that the storm had indeed ended. He crawled beneath the thin blanket and soon fell back to sleep. He dreamed of Joanna, the two of them walking across the desert wearing ordinary street clothes. He could not tell if the desert was on Earth or Mars. A city shone on the horizon, white and sparkling in the hot sun. But no matter how long they walked, the city came no closer. They trudged along for hours, tired, thirsty, sweaty, but the gleaming towers remained nothing more than a hope in the distance. They became weaker and weaker. Joanna collapsed in his arms, suddenly naked. They both sank to the burning sand, dying, too weak to go any farther. Jamie had his fetish in his hand, but the little stone bear melted beneath the awful heat and flowed between his fingers. He was reaching for it, scrabbling in the sand to recover it, when he awoke and realized he was pawing at the sheet that had become tangled between his legs. Sheepishly, Jamie got out of his bunk and headed for the lavatory before any of the others awoke. For the first time since they had left the dome, he shaved. The razor seemed to be slicing flesh, even though it drew no blood. No blood left in me, Jamie thought wearily. The lotion stung when he splashed it on, but the sharpness of the pain was almost welcome after days of the dull, sullen, glowering ache that had been dogging him. Thanks, Jamie muttered to his freshly shaved image in the lab's metal mirror. I needed that. The face that looked back at him was gaunt, red-eyed, with hollows beneath the high cheekbones. You're turning into a pale face, Jamie said to it. Joanna seemed wearier, too, and Ilona barely managed to pull herself out of her bunk and make it to the lavatory. After a glum breakfast, Jamie accompanied Connors outside, despite the astronaut's mild protests. There won't be a media conference until the antenna's fixed, Jamie pointed out, so there's no reason for me to stay inside. He got the impression that the astronaut was too weak, too much in pain, to argue. Jamie himself felt ragged and tired. The night's sleep had done nothing to restore his strength. The achy feeling that had assailed him for 2 days now was worse. Every muscle in his body felt strained. Morning mists hovered as they stepped out from the airlock. Tendrils of cold gray fog drifted by, slowly as departing spirits. Where does the moisture come from? Jamie asked himself again. It's being replenished every day. It evaporates when the sun touches it, and then more mist forms the next morning. How? Why? Connors ignored the mist.
Looks like we've got some digging to do.
The rover was piled almost roof high with sand on its windward side, nearly buried in dust so fine and loose that it blew up in powdery clouds when the two hard-suited men stepped in it.
Good thing the hatch is on the sheltered side,
Jamie said.
I don't think the sand's heavy enough to keep the hatch closed,
Connor said as they walked through the powdery drifts, tossing up plumes of dust with each booted step.
We could have pushed it open with no sweat, I bet you.
Maybe, Jamie said to himself. Connors clambered slowly, awkwardly up the ladder set into the command module side just behind the cockpit canopy and began to examine the microwave antenna.
Just what I thought,
Jamie heard in his earphones as he waited at the ladder's base.
Goddamn dust wormed its way out of the gasket seal. Oh, shit. I can't believe I did that. What? Are you okay? Yeah. Just dumb, that's all. I tried to blow the dust out of the gasket.
Connors was grumbling to himself. Then Jamie realized.
With your helmet on. Fogged up the faceplate real nice. Turn off the blower. Already have. It's clearing up.
Connors came down and went to the outside equipment compartment on the lab module for tools, a fine wire brush and a shovel. In a few minutes, he had the antenna mount clear of dust. Over the suit radios, they asked Joanna to check the TV link. They saw the antenna arm unfold. Then the dish turned slowly until it locked under their spacecraft orbiting over the equator. Joanna reported that she had contacted the dome without difficulty.
Boss Nesensky says the news conference will start in another hour, if we can be ready by then,
she reported.
No sweat,
said Connors. Jamie grunted to himself. In fact, he was perspiring heavily inside his suit and was certain that Connors was too.
You go in now,
the astronaut said to Jamie.
I'll go around the other side and dig out one of the wheels. See if we can get away without digging out the others.
I can help.
No, it's okay. This stuff is so fluffy you can blow it away with a whisk broom. If I need help, I'll ask you. Maybe we'll have a digging party after the media conference, all four of us. You sure you'll be okay out here? I'm no hero, Jamie. If I need help, I'll yell. Don't worry.
Reluctantly, Jamie went back inside. It took much longer than usual to vacuum the dust off his suit. Leaving his helmet in the airlock, he tramped the length of the command module to the cockpit. Joanna was in the pilot seat, speaking into the display screen. Jamie recognized the face of Bert Klein, the American astronaut on Mars 2. Klein